The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, "They Gave Me Grit." For 60-plus years, Steve Stroud has bought, sold, and brokered land in North Carolina, but his life got filled up with so much more than just real estate. And the article actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, "Decades of deal-making. Steve Stroud's love for land continues to shape the Triangle." This article is written by Dane Huffman. The phone rang in the offices of C.L. Adams Realty Company, and Steve Stroud, still early in his career, took a call that would change his life. He had entered NC State University in 1961, but left before graduating. Marriage and a new child will make you hungry for a dollar. And took a job in real estate, having developed a keen appreciation for the value of land from his father. Stroud, 76, was born in Rutherford County, a rural area west of Charlotte, and his first home had no running water. His parents, in fact, started their married life using tin cans for chairs. His mother sewed together clothes for Steve and his brother Doug for much of their childhood. Like many who are poor, the family respected land and the bounty it could bring. "My dad was into it. He started out with 40 acres, and when he died, he had 400 acres," Stroud says. "He loved land, and he taught my brother and I to love the land. He had great respect for land." Stroud left NC State for a job handling credit for Algie Stevens, a developer from Garner, who helped build the North Hills Office Center. In 1967, he joined C.L. Adams Realty Company in Raleigh. Clarence Adams was a naval officer in World War II, serving on a ship designed to chase German submarines. "He was my mentor and my teacher," Stroud remembers. "He was never looking here or back here. He was always looking out there. He used to always tell me, 'You can't see the horizon if you're looking at your feet.'" Adams assembled land in places such as North Hills and North Ridge and even Cary when it was a village of 7,000 people. "He taught me the basic things you need to look for if you were going to sell land as an investment," Stroud says, "so that was my focus." That focus, forged by a keen sense of the market and a fierce desire to show Raleigh's elite that the kid from the hills of Rutherford County belonged, sparked a career that has spanned decades and gained the trust of the market leaders. Stroud, with a booming voice, broad chest, and a bolo tie that was a nod to his rural roots, would play a large role in where the Triangle lives and plays. This year marks a transition half a century in the making, the first time since 1972 in which Stroud isn't leading his own firm now that NAI, Caro Atlantic, has merged with Tri Properties. Stroud remains a minority stakeholder and a broker at the firm, as well as a voice still sought for his insight into the rapidly changing market. "He was ahead of his time as far as doing big land assemblages here in the Triangle," says Greg Sanchez, the president of Tri Properties, who oversees the merged operation. "He was the first guy here to do big assemblages of land. He and his company were doing the majority of the land brokerages, and clearly anything of size they were usually touching." But to do that, Stroud needed Raleigh's investors to believe in him. And when the phone rang that day at C.L. Adams, on the line was General Parts owner O. Temple Sloan, Jr., looking for a new location for a warehouse. "I told Clarence about it, and he said, 'Go find something,'" Stroud recalls. "So I went to work on it and found a piece of land where I thought he ought to build a new distribution center." Thrilled with the chance to help Sloan, one of Raleigh's business leaders, Stroud found a location on Atlantic Avenue that would have access to the new Beltline and even rail if General Parts needed. Stroud thought it was perfect. He soon learned he was wrong. A love for land. Many of the leaders of Raleigh's real estate community came from families deeply connected to that market. Smeedy's York's father, Willie, developed Cameron Village. Roddy Jones's father, Sebby, was a former Raleigh mayor and founder of an influential construction company. Sloan's father has a park in Sanford named for him. But Stroud's first home had newspapers covering cracks in the walls, and his father had dammed a mountain stream to provide water for the family. When Stroud was 2 years old and his brother Doug was four, the family moved to a four-room house in Rutherford County and finally had electricity. It was quite a step up, he recalls. The family prospered enough to buy clothes from stores, eventually make yearly trips to Myrtle Beach, and send both boys to college. Stroud enrolled at NC State in 1961, awed by the sprawling campus and growing town, and determined to make the most of it. "We were well aware of the sacrifices they made to give us a chance," he says of his parents. "I certainly understood I wasn't going to be given things. I saw my mother and daddy, and they were determined. I saw how hard they worked to get there, the determination they had." He carried that determination with him to C.L. Adams and began scouting for land for General Parts. Stroud worked up a deal for the land on Atlantic Avenue and soon found it had issues based on how it was subdivided. "I sold him something that was the right place, but it had problems," he recalls of the deal with Sloan. "I decided that this was something I should have known about and I had to fix. So the commission I got out of that, I spent fixing it, probably plus some," he says. "That sort of cemented our relationship." Seeing the future. Powered by that connection and wielding a forceful personality, Stroud's influence rose. He founded what is now NAI, Carroll Atlantic Realty, in 1972, and it grew to become one of the market's largest brokerage firms with tentacles reaching across several landmark real estate projects. Stroud found the land for the start of Highwoods Properties, which opened in 1978, and included such power brokers as Sloan and developer Roddy Jones. "He'd always be the land man," Joan recalls. "Sloan was the money man, and I'd be the builder." Jones and Sloan appreciated that Stroud had a resilience that was hard to beat as he worked through the details of putting together complex deals. "He's such a straight shooter, you just had to like him," Jones says. "We probably kidded him about being from the boondocks without really realizing what he'd been through." Through the years, the deals kept coming. Stroud assembled the land for the Imperial Center and first recognized the potential of the empty spaces at Briar Creek. And he worked to pull off the 525,000-square-foot White Oak Crossing shopping center in Garner that included multiple big-box tenants. Stroud once said the project was complex, almost beyond my comprehension, he said. But in his folksy way, he praised Manning Fulton attorney Charles Fulton for seeing it through, as if carrying a bucket of frogs with no lid, saying, "Charlie is the only attorney I know who can carry that bucket and keep all the frogs from jumping out." But Stroud carried plenty of buckets on his own. Barlow Hergett remembers Stroud calling after Hergett won a seat on the Raleigh City Council in 1989. "He was very agreeable. He was one of the first guys who called up after the election and wanted to work with me on stuff and congratulate me," Hergett says. "And I appreciated that, and it told me he was somebody you could work with." Stroud was his own man. In a town of khaki pants and blue blazers, he wore a bolo tie and even kept some moonshine in his office, although he almost never drank, as a reminder of his past. "He's very driven," Sanchez says, "and he has never forgotten his humble beginnings. He has felt like he needed to work hard to get where he needed to go because nothing was handed to him." And that drive would sometimes be questioned. For example, it became statewide news in 1996 when he and Carlton Midyet sold land appraised at $500,000 to the state for $3.7 million, as the state needed the land for a highway near Raleigh-Durham International Airport, according to news reports at the time. Arena bound. But nothing drove Stroud like his quest for a new basketball arena for NC State. In 1983, he was president of the Wolfpack Club and was five rows behind the bench in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for NC State's stunning victory over the University of Houston in the NCAA Finals. Coach Jim Valvano even asked Stroud and his father to fly back on the team plane. "Of course, my dad couldn't believe it," he says. "You can't imagine someone from Rutherford County, what they felt to see NC State win the national championship, and then he gets to fly back with the coach and the guys. It was just a magic trip, and Jim talked to him just like he was family." Weeks later, Valvano met Stroud and Wolfpack Club Executive Director Charlie Bryant for lunch near campus to discuss replacing Reynolds Coliseum. He said, "It's time. If we're going to have a big-time basketball program at NC State, we've got to build it," Stroud recalls, "and he sold us." They knew UNC Chapel Hill was planning the Smith Center, which opened in 1986. Stroud enlisted the support of state leaders and pushed back when Raleigh Mayor Tom Fetzer and others raised concerns about cost. The Wolfpackers wanted an arena comparable to the Smith Center. Mark Scruggs, then a Raleigh City Council member, remembers going to a lunch with Stroud and others to tell the group the council would vote unanimously for a smaller arena, but had concerns about the viability of a larger one. Stroud refused to budge. I remember one promise Steve made to me at that meeting was, "Mark, I will guarantee you that we will have NCAA regionals here within X years, and we want things like the CIAA tournament," Scruggs says. "And everything they predicted has really come true," Scruggs adds, "with the exception of being development around the arena has lagged." Working behind the scenes, Stroud pulled together key forces from state and local government to NC State, and ultimately then Carolina Hurricanes owner Peter Karmanos to get the deal done. One of the roads into the arena is named in Stroud's honor. He remembers later hearing Fetzer speak at the NC Museum of Art, Stroud says. He saw me sitting back there and said, "Well, I see Steve Stroud is with us. Let me tell you a story about him. You all know I did everything I could to keep that arena from being built, and Stroud ran over me like a Mack truck." Stroud smiles and adds, "That's not true, but if I'd let him dictate what we did, it wouldn't be there." A changing perspective. In October 2011, Stroud was changing the battery on his tractor at his home in Lee County when he reached across the tractor and didn't realize it was in gear. The tractor lurched forward, knocked him down, and ran over him. He called 911, and when they asked how bad he was hurt, he said, "Real bad." A miraculous series of coincidences saved his life, with the EMS crew right near his house when he called, a life flight crew already in Lee County, and the pilot flying the helicopter knowing the exact location of his house because of its copper roof. It makes you focus more on what's important, the fact that God let me survive and made me aware that I needed to do more than I was doing, he says. Stroud moved from a wheelchair to a cane to walking again, but change would come rapidly at NAI Carroll Atlantic. In 2018, one of the firm's top performers, Moss Withers, left to lead the Lee & Associates branch in the Triangle. Withers says he left for the opportunity. "My performance created a reason that made me sought after from New Flags trying to enter the market," he says. "I wanted to be like Steve. He's the 100% owner. He was not ready to let that go." In January 2019, Stroud announced former Carolina Hurricanes general manager Ron Francis would join the firm. That lasted 7 months before Francis took command of Seattle's new National Hockey League franchise. Stroud says the deal was just too good for Francis to pass up. The future of NAI Carroll Atlantic became clear in November when Stroud and Sanchez announced Tri-Properties of Durham and NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty of Raleigh would form what was billed as a merger effective January 1, although Sanchez took on the lead role. The deal has created a firm of more than 70 employees and 24 brokers, creating a company with a wider variety of offerings. The two have known each other since 1985, and Stroud says, "There have been no disappointments. We've meshed very well. Anytime you merge two firms, there are some realignments and adjustments and redundancies, and that's never fun." Stroud is in no hurry to exit the stage. Sanchez says he expects Stroud to work another 5 years or more, as long as his health allows. And Stroud continues to mentor young brokers on the fine points of the real estate business. He continues to drive to his West Raleigh office from his home in Lee County, often looking at the land around him and seeing its potential. "He's always said to focus on Sanford," recalls Withers, quoting Stroud as saying, "Sanford will be the next incredible opportunity in the market." It's just another chapter in the long career of a man whose parents taught him to work hard and to love and value land. "I've never done a significant deal when I didn't think about my mother and daddy," Stroud says. "If they gave me anything, they gave me grit." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. Chef and Farmers Howard raves about Kerry food scene. Vivian Howard is about to return to the air on PBS, and her new exploration of interesting foods across the South took her to a surprising place, Kerry. Howard, owner of Kinston's Chef and the Farmer restaurant, did the highly popular A Chef's Life on PBS for 5 seasons, but felt the show, centered around eastern North Carolina, had run its course. "So we wanted to evolve the narrative to broaden the scope of what people define as Southern food," she says. Her new 6-part series, Somewhere South, debuts March 27. Howard hosts a public screening of the show March 15 at the Carolina Theater in Durham. In the series, she goes to Asheville to explore the impact of pickles, to Durham for Italian-style dumplings, to Charleston, South Carolina, to explore the impact of African Americans on Southern cuisine, and of course explores Eastern North Carolina barbecue. Howard also visited Cary for a Sag Paneer lesson from friends Rakesh and Akna Anand. One of the surprising things for me was going up there and having a perception of Cary as the quintessential, like, white suburban town or suburb, if you will, and then learning that it's really one of the most diverse communities in our state, and then learning all about the amazing food options that are a result of that, she says. Howard noted the wide variety of supermarkets in Cary, including Indian and Korean options. If you're into food and into looking into and learning about all types of cuisine, you couldn't land in a better place than Cary, she says. Classic Orangina bottles are returning to shelves. Those bulb-shaped bottles of Orangina are coming back to the United States, thanks to Ventures Food and Beverage and Pepsi Bottling Ventures. Ventures Food and Beverage, a brand accelerator division of Raleigh-based Pepsi Bottling, recently acquired the licensing of the citrus beverage, which is popular in Europe, and plans to bring it back to grocery shelves here in the U.S. this year. The memorable glass bottles are also returning. The bottles are recyclable and reusable. There is a worldwide affinity for Orangina, and we are excited to celebrate this new chapter for the iconic brand, says Paul Finney, CEO of Pepsi Bottling Ventures. First homes in Chatham Park will be cottages. The first homes in the huge Chatham Park project in Pittsburgh will be dubbed the Cottages, and on the small side, the cottages will feature one of four layout types with names such as hot chocolate, apple pie, milk and cookies, and chicken noodle soup. The homes will be one- and two-story homes ranging from 828 square feet to 1,397 square feet. Prices will start in the low 200,000s. The builder is Cary-based Garmin Homes. The first group of homes will feature 30 cottages and is scheduled to deliver in October. The new homes will be situated across the street from a new 10-acre town park, and all the homes will be within walking distance from downtown Pittsburgh, developers say. We're building to deliver an experience-rich, simplistic lifestyle, says Rebecca McAdoo, division president with Garmin Homes. More and more people are purging their clutter and desiring spaces that are artfully designed to the way they want to live. The cottages will celebrate this lifestyle choice. Thrive NC Festival is a hot ticket in Raleigh. The Thrive NC Festival is clearly a hit, as tickets for the Friday session of the two-day food and beverage festival in May sold out in 2 days. Raleigh chef Ashley Christensen will lead cooking demonstrations both nights, and the festival features samples from top local restaurants. Some tickets remain for the May 7 session at City Market in downtown Raleigh. Proceeds support nonprofits that work to provide healthy, affordable food for those in need. Over 2 years, ticket proceeds and donations have raised nearly $750,000. Life Sciences Leader sees path to innovation and fundraising. A well-known Triangle entrepreneur is launching a new venture company aimed at providing senior leadership to startups in life sciences. Meg Powell, the founder of Target Pharma Solutions, who grew the company to 75 employees and $20 million in revenue before selling it to Northwest Venture Partners, has created 501 Ventures. Her goal is to put together experienced leaders who can serve as a stand-in management team for a company attempting to grow beyond seed stage. Initially, the company will focus on non-oncology, small molecule companies that need to raise between $5 million and $15 million to progress to its next stage. People disguise this in the area as, oh, it's so hard to raise money, Powell says. But I think so much of our problem is people don't know how to raise money. They don't have the right group of people looking at the problem. And finally, firms scramble as impact of coronavirus grows. As the coronavirus continues to spread, some executives say their firms have fared better than others. Dave Flitman, CEO of Raleigh building supply manufacturer BMC Stock Holdings, said on a recent earnings call, "We're working closely with our suppliers. Don't anticipate any major supply chain disruptions at this point, but certainly we're going to stay close to it." CEO Eric Lloyd of Barings BDC, which encompasses what used to be Raleigh's Triangle Capital Corporation, said on a call that when it comes to supply chains and the concentration of customers in China, we're going through all that now. And now we turn to Lauren Onosorge's page on banking, tech, and transportation. The first headline, Triangle on short list of for 200 jobs car plant. The futuristic vehicles, the brainchild of Canadian firm Electra Mechanica, look like a slanted sedan. Instead of four wheels spinning down the highway, they have three. And the driver is the sole occupant. If North Carolina plays its cards right, the electric solo vehicles could soon come from a local assembly line. As the company has confirmed, the Raleigh area is on its shortlist for a new 200-job manufacturing site. In an exclusive interview, CEO Paul Rivera says what his company is looking for is space and talent. Already alongside its partner, Zongshin Industrial Group, Rivera's company has a 150,000-square-foot production facility in China. It's ready to go, he says. The company has tested pre-production vehicles from that facility and likes the results, Rivera says. Long term, that facility will continue to supply the global market. It will also supply kits for the U.S. market. The kits will be assembled at the planned U.S. production facility to supply the cars domestically. He declines to talk about the specs of the planned site, but says it's unlikely to be smaller than what's in China because, in addition to kit assembly, the plan is to locate an engineering center at the site. That means that in addition to a talent pool ripe with skilled manufacturing labor, Electra Mechanica is also looking for engineering talent. Ideally, it wants to find people with backgrounds in everything from electrification to energy storage and software. The company will consider both existing buildings and empty sites, Rivera says. We don't want to limit ourselves, he says. We're open to either option. Electra Mechanica is also looking for locations close to transportation hubs, as shipping and logistics will be important to the operation. And of course, we want to be somewhere where the state wants us, where there's interest from the state, where there's interest in working with us, Rivera says. The NC Department of Commerce declined to confirm any talks with Electra Mechanica, citing its usual stance on active projects. Prescient recovers from fire. Nearly a year after a fire from a gas explosion destroyed its downtown Durham headquarters, Prescient is still innovating. The company had moved its headquarters from Denver to Durham 3 years ago, with executives ambitious that their company could be the answer to affordable housing concerns across the country, potentially even the globe. Its five-dimensional software could design buildings up to 16 stories. Its manufacturing outfit, with a new plant in nearby Mebane, could print the parts, from trusses to panels, that construction crews used to assemble the structures on site. Then the explosion struck April 10, 2019. Prescient was lucky, Executive Chairman Satyen Patel says. While two people died in the fire, Prescient's employees got out in time. We were fortunate that we got away, he says. Obviously, it was a setback for us. Afterward, employees were moved to other locations, from Mebane to Charlotte. The August before the explosion, the company has started employing architects and designers in Charlotte. At the time of the fire, the firm already had about 20 employees there, so it decided to consolidate by moving its headquarters from Durham to Charlotte, Patel says. Sometimes things happen for a reason, he says. It allows you to rethink your strategy and your long-term horizons. It gave us the opportunity to expand into Charlotte. Even with the setback, the company reported 40% year-over-year growth in 2019, he says, and it's in line for between 40 and 60% growth this year. Outer Banks Wind Farm has site assessment plan approved. The possibility of a wind farm off the Outer Banks is closer to being a reality. 3 years after submitting the winning bid for what's known as the Kitty Hawk Tract, Avangrid is ready for the next round of paperwork. On February 20, its site assessment plan was approved by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Avangrid CEO Jim Torgerson said on an earnings call with analysts. Company spokesman Paul Koppelman says, or calls it, a step that enables us to move forward with the next round of data gathering and resources assessment, including deploying a buoy to gather meteorological and ocean data. He says much more is ahead, adding, this remains a deliberative and consultative process with a lot of important voices participating. First Citizen CEO Holding sees compensation rise. As First Citizens Bank continues to expand outside of its Raleigh footprint, its top executives are inking millions. Securities filings show CEO Frank Holding Jr. saw a raise in his base salary for 2020, a 1.4% increase that brought that figure to $981,000. But if last year is any indication, he'll likely receive much more in 2020. Including incentives and other compensation, he was paid more than $4 million in 2019 compared to more than $2.8 million a year ago. Wake Stone says judge's order won't slow quarry. In the ongoing battle over land use at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, a Wake County judge has granted an injunction that could prohibit a quarry expansion until 2022. But the order, which prohibits mining, but not activities such as tree clearing and bridge building, until either 2022 or the end of the ongoing litigation, doesn't impact the timeline for Wake Stone Corporation for a quarry expansion near Umstead State Park, says President Sam Bratton. We believe the Court of Appeals will hear this before 2022, Bratton says. But that amount of time really doesn't give us much pause. We feel we have a really strong ruling from the judge. His firm is still pushing ahead with plans to file for its mining permit in the next few months. The mine permit is performance-based, he says. You meet the criteria, you should get the permit. If the permit review process just looks at the regulatory requirements, we feel we can satisfy all those requirements. Now, certainly there's interpretation for others that will be different, but we do believe we'll be granted a permit. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Harris Teeter to anchor Carrboro Project. Plans for a mixed-use destination in Carrboro took a big leap forward recently when a grocery chain bought the land for the project. Harris Teeter has closed on 40 acres of land proposed for the Lloyd Farm mixed-use development. The company paid $10.6 million for the property. The site is situated at the corner of NC Highway 54 and Old Fayetteville Road, across the street from Carrboro Place and west of downtown and Chapel Hill. Plans for the store call for 60,000 square feet of retail space set to anchor the 40-acre site. A representative for Harris Teeter says the company is not yet ready to share further details on the project. Altogether, plans for Lloyd Farm call for 125,000 square feet of retail space, including the new Harris Teeter, and additional commercial parcels, as well as a 220-unit senior living campus called the Lofts at Lloyd Farm. The residential space breaks down to 200 apartments and 20 duplex cottage units. Argus Development Group is the lead developer on the project. EYC Companies and the Calico Group will handle development of the residential component. The town of Carrboro has been reviewing plans for Lloyd Farm for several years. In late 2019, the town approved a conditional use permit for the first phase of construction. That phase includes the grocery store and a collection of commercial properties. The apartments and other commercial outparcels are planned for future phases. Dallas firm plans to demolish University Inn and build apartments. A Dallas developer has big plans to transform the site of a decades-old defunct motel in Chapel Hill into a mixed-use complex with hundreds of apartments. Leon Capital Group has filed plans to demolish the existing buildings at the site of University Inn in Chapel Hill's Blue Hill District. Redevelopment plans seek to make the property into a seven-story complex with 344,244 square feet of commercial and multifamily space. The hotel served guests for decades before abruptly closing last year after a lengthy legal battle between the landowner and the operators of the inn. Altogether, the new structure would feature around 341 one- and two-bedroom residential units and approximately 18,450 square feet of commercial space on the northern end of the site, as well as structured parking for nearly all of the parking spaces. The property is situated on 3.9 acres at 1301 Fordham Drive, across the street from the Eastgate Shopping Center. The application to the town lists Leon Capital Group as the owner contract purchaser. The land is currently owned by RME Management LLC of Georgia. Raleigh engineering firm Pannoni filed the plans on behalf of Leon Capital, and Klein Design is behind the site plans. Leon Capital did not return calls for comment. Raleigh real estate veterans leave Colliers for Avison Young. Three Raleigh veterans have left their longtime tenures at a Triangle brokerage firm to become the newest principals at Avison Young's office for Raleigh and Durham. Avison Young has appointed Kathy Gigak, Baxter Walker, and Thomas Kenna as Avison Young principals, Enterprise Solutions, in the firm's local office. They worked at Colliers International before the company announced the end of its agreement with its Triangle affiliate late last year. John Linderman, Avison Young Principal and Regional Managing Director for North Carolina, says his firm could not be more excited to have Kathy Baxter and Thomas join the Avison Young family. The trio specializes in occupier solutions, identifying and working with potential tenants and property buyers. In the last few years at Colliers, the team completed more than 2 million square feet of transactions valued at around $250 million, according to Avison Young. Briar Creek Retail Center preps for more expansion. A retail center in Briar Creek is gearing up for the final phase of an expansion as it transitions from traditional retail and big box stores to a one-stop shop for health, wellness, and specialty retail. The Focus Properties of Raleigh is finalizing its plans for the third phase of a multi-part expansion at the Shops at Alexander Place, with up to 46,000 additional square feet to be developed in the coming years. The shopping center is situated at the intersection of Glenwood Avenue and Briar Creek Parkway. The Focus Properties has not set a strict timeline for the start of the latest phase, but site plans have been filed with the City of Raleigh. We were hoping to break ground at the end of this year, but it's going to depend on potential junior anchors, says Pratik Shandak, president of Focus Properties. The initial plans and site plans were designed prior to Planet Fitness lease. Currently, those plans show a collection of two-story retail and office spaces. The company has yet to announce any new tenants for the final phase. And finally, Michiganders drop $40 million plus on Durham Life Sciences portfolio. A Michigan group paid nearly $41 million for a portfolio of life sciences properties in the Triangle as the firm builds its presence in the region. Allidade Capital spent $40.9 million on the purchase of the Bradford Center and the Barrington Center, which together total more than 220,000 square feet of fully leased single-story office and research space. The buildings are situated at 5827 and 5927 South Miami Boulevard in Durham's Imperial Center Office Park. The Bradford Center features 121,833 square feet of space, and the Barrington Center has 102,896. The JLL Capital Markets team of Ryan Clutter, Scott Humphrey, Chris Norbell, and Valerie Derrick represented seller Crown Realty and Development and procured the buyer in an off-market transaction, according to JLL. With long-term leases and the property's strategic location to many of the tenants' headquarters, this was a great opportunity for the buyer, said Greg Grote, Chief Operating Officer at Crown Realty. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Seth Thomas Gulledge's page on healthcare. Heat Bio looks to develop coronavirus vaccine. Heat Biologics of Mooresville has unveiled its plan to develop a potential vaccine for the novel coronavirus. The company is launching a program to adapt its existing vaccine platform for potential treatment of COVID-19. Specifically, the company will be attempting to develop a vaccine through its subsidiary, Zolovax. The company will be using its GP96 vaccine platform, which activates the immune system to treat or prevent infection from the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus that causes the COVID-19 disease. CEO Jeff Wolf says the company has long known its platform could have applications beyond its current development for oncology, and it demonstrated effectiveness in other viral models, such as malaria, in preclinical studies. We've understood for a long time that we have a very interesting and potent vaccine platform. As a small company with very limited resources, we can't take on every disease in the world, he says. We have to be selective, and we truly have to pick and choose our fights. Wolf says the company is creating the vaccine and will soon do preclinical testing and then explore clinical trials. He says they have not released any guidance on how long the runway to approval may be. As a small drug developer, Wolf says the company plans to look for public funding to finance the development. There's quite a bit of grant funding out there for this right now, he says, so we would avail ourselves of public funding for this. I think the administration has been very good in respect to resources available, and we've truly been emboldened by the efforts of the White House and Vice President Mike Pence in finding private enterprise and finding solutions for the pandemic. RTP firm to explore how Uber Lyft could help fight HIV. One of the largest determining factors for chronic disease patients is access to care, especially for HIV, which is why Durham's Viv Healthcare is launching a study in the Carolinas looking at how Uber and Lyft could improve patient outcomes. Viv Healthcare, which calls Research Triangle Park the home of its U.S. headquarters, wants to know if ride-sharing apps could be utilized to increase outcomes for HIV patients, a modernized play on previous methods to increase access through transportation. Tamika Evans, the company's director of Global Public Health and Innovation, says the theory is that using the modern convenience and innovation that companies such as Uber and Lyft have spearheaded in recent years, providers could increase the rate that HIV patients seek medical care, a primary contributing factor to overall outcomes. What we're essentially looking at is the innovation of ride-sharing compared to other types of transportation assistance that clinics have been using for decades, she says, mentioning things such as taxi vouchers and bus passes. What we found is that the utilization of those options has not been optimal or fully used as the resources are available. UNC study tracks cancer fight over 30 years. A recent review of cancer survival rates over 30 years shows significant improvement in key areas, but researchers at UNC Chapel Hill found the improvement was largely absent from certain kinds of cancers. According to a new study in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, the 5-year survival rate for adolescents and young adults with cancer significantly improved from 1975 to 2005 throughout the U.S. But, says Hazel Nichols, an associate professor in the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health, we have to make sure that overall improvements don't hide the fact that there are specific cancer types that haven't had equivalent advances, and we need to do more. The study showed dramatic improvements in mortality rates for leukemia, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, Hodgkin lymphoma, central nervous system tumors, melanoma and other skin cancers, breast cancer or kidney cancers. But in the same 30-year period, mortality rates for patients with bone tumors, soft tissue sarcomas, bladder cancer, cervical and uterine cancers, or colorectal cancer failed to improve at all. Novon closes $5.9 million secondary offering. Morrisville-based Novon has closed on a $5.95 million offering of its shares as it continues to fight for financing to lead its lead drug asset to approval. The public offering consisted of 18.3 million shares of its common stock, as well as warrants to purchase 18.3 million shares. The gross proceeds of the offering were expected to be about $5.5 million, but came in higher with the partial exercise of the underwriter's option to purchase additional shares. The offering follows Novon's filing of a $150 million mixed shelf registration with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for common and preferred stock, debt securities, warrants, and units. At the time of that filing, the market value of all outstanding stock held by non-affiliates was $76.6 million through 27.4 million shares. And a number? 13.7 million, the amount in cash the company has as of its most recent filing in 2019. Its total operating expenses figure for the year was $35.5 million. And finally, in a section called He Said It, they might worry if you wait too long from the disease onset, the treatment may not work as well. But if you don't enroll patients, we won't know if the treatment works at all. That's Dr. Michael Pensina, Duke Clinical Research Institute biostatistician, who says that the criteria established in China's ongoing clinical trials for a potential treatment of COVID-19 may be too stringent and could be hindering progress. And now we move over to the On Restaurants and Retail page written by Dathan Kazak. Her pastry touch is now getting national attention. Crystal Swenson, the pastry chef for Scott Crawford's Jolie and Crawford & Son restaurants, recently was named one of 20 semifinalists for Outstanding Pastry Chef in the 2020 James Beard Awards. Swenson is the only pastry chef in the state up for the award. How did you get your start in pastries? I took a food service class in high school in Hawaii, kind of on a whim. I was in art class, which happened to be next door to the food service classroom. We would be working on our art assignments, and it would usually be pretty focused and quiet. But then these aromas from the classroom next door would flow in, and it was so alluring, almost distracting. I decided I'd enroll the following year, and that was really the catalyst. It was an art class, but just in a different medium. Working together with other students, the teamwork and the camaraderie was also something that I found myself drawn to. I was also very lucky to have an inspiring teacher, Elise Miura, who mentored me and encouraged me to pursue a future in cooking because she said she had seen how much I took to it. What have you learned working with Crawford? He has really taught me how to be confident in my creative process and my direction. I've learned to embrace classic flavor combinations and then layer in our experiences. I am so fortunate to have a chef who respects my opinions and allows me to have creative freedom. What's your signature dish? I've never been one to single out one dish as a signature. It's important to allow dishes to evolve and to let them go through edits and revisions. I'll bring back certain flavor combinations or techniques that I'm fond of, but I usually find myself trying to improve on the idea, and in turn, it may end up being a more focused version that I like better. I will say that I always enjoy making ice creams and cookies or textural components of dishes. The possibilities are endless. How many of the semifinalists do you know? There are many of the nominated chefs that I've admired and looked up to, but haven't met personally. It's all very humbling and surreal to be in the same category as them. I've looked up to Lincoln Carson, Margarita Mansky, and Diana Mua for years, and they are definite veterans in the industry. I'm very excited to see Mimi Mendoza nominated for her work at Sania in Hawaii. What do you do for fun? I enjoy spending time with my partner, Brett Edlin, in and outside the kitchen with our little hound dog, Valentino. Rocky Mount Brewery to more than double in size. Rocky Mount's Hop Fly Brewing Company is opening its new tap room March 7th inside the Rocky Mount Mills campus. Now in its third year, the brewery has more than doubled in size from its original space that was 700 square feet. The new space totals 1,600 square feet. Rocky Mountain Mills has provided an excellent platform for starter breweries, and it was the perfect place for me to start Hopfly, founder Cameron Schultz says. When talk of the mill becoming a brewery incubator first gained attention, Schultz, a Chapel Hill native, grabbed one of the original locations in 2017. The new tap room will still feature the brewery's signature IPA and lagers, plus a rotating selection of seasonal and collaborative beers. The tap room will be pet-friendly and feature outdoor seating, a collection of games, live music, and events. We're excited to bring a first-class tap room experience to beer enthusiasts and visitors to the area, Schultz says. Matt Honeycutt, real estate development manager for Rocky Mountain Mills, notes, "We are thrilled that our very first incubator tenant has not only fledged into a successful brewery, but also that they decided to double down and grow right here with us at Rocky Mount Mills." Coffee brand that supports women featured. Starting March 8, several Triangle cafes and restaurants will showcase Cafe Femenino Coffee, a retail brand that started in Peru as a way to empower women by providing them a source of income. During a week-long celebration of International Women's Day, several local shops will spotlight Cafe Femenino Coffee. Sarah Cuny, owner of the Root Cellar Cafe and Catering, says, "We are partnering with Cafe Femenino Coffee to celebrate and amplify the voices of the brave women coffee farmers who have stood up to improve their lives and the lives of their families and communities." Local shops that will feature the coffee include Garland, Gold Cup, Jack Tar, Lantern, the coffee shop at the Durham Hotel, and Root Cellar Cafe and Catering. And finally, in a section called He Said It, "My goal is to expand the brand back in Charlotte and get Dilworth's Coffee back to what it once was when the brand was founded." And that's from Peter Floyd, Director of Sales and Marketing at Dilworth's Coffee, on expanding the brand back into Charlotte. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline: When I Met Jack Welch in Raleigh back in 2012. It was in the fall of 2012. Rick Deckelbaum, the organizer of the NC CEO Forum, was kind enough to carve out a few minutes for me to talk to Jack Welch, the forum's keynote speaker that year. It was at Sullivan's Restaurant in downtown Raleigh the night before the start of the forum, and Welch, as usual, was soaking in the praise from the Triangle business elite. I had read Welch's book, Winning, and I remembered he wrote about how he directed his management staff to spend most of their time with the performers at GE and cut ties with those who didn't. So when I met him for the first time, I told him I had read his book and that principle stood out to me. And I asked how one creates a sense of empowerment and collaboration in an environment of such cutthroat culture. His answer, stick to the winners and try to breed as many of them as possible if you are a manager. I followed up with the question of him being branded Neutron Jack during the days of mass layoffs at GE and the company closing facilities in the U.S. and opening new centers, production operations abroad, that provided cheap labor. Again, he said the company needed to put out better margins and for the sake of the majority of GE workers, pruning the company's workforce was necessary. We small talked for a bit longer, but I did sense he never liked the Neutron Jack moniker in his tumultuous days at GE. Welch had his own way of impressing business executives. Diane Adams, who worked at Allscripts as the company's chief human resources official, recalled that during Welch's same visit, she quizzed him about whether he was aware she had bagged three HR executives from GE way back in the 1990s when she worked for a different employer. He immediately remembered the names of those execs I hired from GE, she says. It really was remarkable that at the age of 77, his memory was so sharp. One could argue Welch was the reason so many executives in the U.S. got bolder with worker retrenchments and fine-tuning the company's mission focused on shareholder value during the 1980s and 1990s. Then came the revolution of the creative class, where collaboration, interdependence, and flattening org charts became more important than just enhancing shareholder value. To stay relevant, Welch changed much of his tune from his winning days and in fact said, "Your main constituencies are your employees, your customers, and your product." Welch was a changed man. But had someone asked the 112,000 GE workers who lost their jobs, they would have said Welch's newfound management directive was insincere and disingenuous. Regardless, Welch was a towering presence in the U.S. economy. To this day, business schools across the world ask students to write case studies on how GE shifted its business from being a manufacturer to a financial services company in the 1990s. When Welch took over GE in 1981, GE's revenue was about $28 billion. When he left in 2001, the company recorded $130 billion in revenue the year before. Welch died March 1. And depending on which side of Jack you see most vividly, he certainly left a lasting legacy in the business community. Also on the Viewpoint page, there's a column written by Aaron Klein, who is a policy director for the Center on Regulation and Markets at Brookings. The headline, "Bank Regulators Should Reveal Secret Ratings." The Federal Reserve and the FDIC requested public input on the Uniform Financial Institution Rating System, better known by the CAMELS acronym, that governs how banks are rated by regulators. CAMELS ratings form the backbone of bank regulation and supervision, making them core to financial regulation. They are confidential, having achieved a legal status that trumps requirements on public companies to disclose material problems. Making banks' composite CAMELS ratings public may seem radical, as they were so carefully guarded that until 1997, bank regulators did not even disclose CAMELS ratings to the bank being rated. However, careful analysis proves that for the largest financial institutions in America, negative CAMELS are already made public. This is because the FDIC publishes the aggregate assets of all troubled institutions, defined on the basis of an aggregate CAMELS rating of a 4 or 5 on a quarterly basis as part of its quarterly banking profile. Currently, those banks have cumulative assets of $49 billion, a range that is consistent with experience during non-crisis periods. This size, coupled with the number of banks with similar asset sizes under $10 billion, makes it essentially impossible to identify specific smaller institutions on the list, providing relative anonymity for smaller institutions. Thus, the current system does in fact make a small subset of the largest financial institutions' ratings cumulative CAMELS public, albeit in an indirectly and slightly lagged basis. This creates an unlevel playing field whereby a series of incentives apply to regulators and financial institutions regarding the ramification of such a downgrade that do not exist for the smaller financial institutions. that the status quo is not consistent across institutions and is arbitrarily applied as it relates to privacy, depending on the size of the institution and the size of other institutions, underscores the need to recognize the problems this creates and consider alternatives. Making all institutions' ratings public is one solution to level the playing field. It has many other positive ramifications, such as providing more information to market participants on the health of financial institutions. After all, shouldn't market participants have the right to know on a high-level basis if the government believes a financial institution is on the brink of collapse? Conversely, if the government believes an institution is in excellent condition, that information is important. Finally, transparency of ratings will improve the quality of financial regulation by requiring regulators to defend their assessments to broader market and public. Two main objections to making CAMELS public are concerns that it would reduce the quality of bank supervision and increase the potential for a run on a bank that has been downgraded. The first fear was used to oppose the transparency increase in the 1990s, telling the banks its own rating. Evidence on the requirement to disclose ratings to the banks being rated shows that there was not a reduction in supervisory effectiveness. Similarly, with regard to run risk, research by the Boston Federal Reserve analyzed the role of increased disclosure of enforcement actions within the U.S. banking context and global banking problems in past crises before the Great Financial Crisis, and found that improving disclosure at troubled U.S. banks during the banking crisis was not destabilizing and did provide conditions for market discipline to work more effectively. Finally, the Dodd-Frank Act created a new failure resolution regime that regulators and policymakers have expressed a great degree of confidence in, containing potential contagion from the idiosyncratic failure of any single large financial institution. So, if such a big bank were to be poorly managed, then policymakers need to let it fail. Making ratings public helps increase accountability for regulators who have pledged to end too big to fail. The existing system has, through an underappreciated set of differing regimes, created a two-tiered regime subjecting the largest financial institutions to a different de facto level of CAMELS publicity than smaller institutions. What was once considered radical and unwise levels of transparency with monetary policy decisions has become the norm. Similarly, a small step in making CAMELS ratings more transparent was undertaken in the late 1990s with positive impacts. And now we'll turn to the small business section to read Jim Verdonick's column. Jim Verdonick is the founder of Innovate Capital Law, which advises entrepreneurs and investors using a toolbox of new legal strategies and business practices. The headline, Top Management Teams Learn to Handle Surprises. The coronavirus outbreak is teaching the global business community tough lessons about the dangers of complicated international supply chains. I'll focus on a lesson that's more relevant to the entrepreneurial community. Investors would rather invest in grade A management teams with grade B business plans than grade A business plans with grade B management teams. Coronavirus is a good example of why that is true. Surprises are always waiting just around the corner. You can only plan for things that aren't surprises. Dealing with surprises tests leadership. After several decades in the tech entrepreneurial space, I still haven't seen a company that had a smooth ride to the top without dealing with many surprises along the way. Grade A management teams quickly assess and deal with the surprises. Sometimes, such as with the coronavirus, the surprise is a threat. Other times, the surprise is a new opportunity. Grade A management teams change their plans to minimize damage from unforeseen threats and redeploy resources to maximize the upside of new opportunities. They don't panic when they face new threats. They also aren't so tied to their business plan that they miss opportunities. So what are the signs of a grade A management team? There are many criteria. Here are three that stand out. Past exits made investors money. Investors like managers who have built winners in the past. The way they rate winners and losers is by the profits investors in prior companies made. Was it 2 times or 5 times or even 20 times? How long did it take? What was the ROI? Does just working at a successful company get you an A grade? No. Investors want to know whether you contributed to the success or were just along for the ride. Be prepared to explain specific contributions. Remember that investors may contact people in that industry to see whether you are stretching the truth. Ability to learn. So if investors in your first two ventures lost money or barely broke even, does that doom you as a manager? No. We shouldn't pretend that failures are as good as winners, but most experienced people have some failures in their resume. Smart investors want to know what managers learned from their past failures. Repeating the same mistakes is what investors fear. Successfully dealing with crises. Most businesses face one or more make or break decisions. Showing investors how you face such situations will win you points. My own experience with bet the company decisions is that you never have all the data points you want before you have to decide what to do. If you wait until you have all the data points, it's too late. The threat kills you or you miss the opportunity. On the other hand, if you make decisions with less than all the data points you can get in a timely manner, you are taking unnecessary risks. Organize your team to identify the data points and rate their relevance. While your team is doing that, determine how much time you have to make and implement your decisions. So what do you do if you and your team have no experience? That's why investors give young startup teams low valuations. But you can attract investors if you demonstrate your potential to grow or your ability to recruit people who have them. And in some general news articles, the Mayton Inn may finally get a new owner. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. A boutique hotel in Cary that's faced troubles may have a potential buyer. New filings in the bankruptcy case of the Mayton Inn's owner reveal an $8.1 million offer made by a company known as Academy Park Hospitality. While filings show the inn's parent company, known in court documents as Memento Mori, has had productive discussions with several potential buyers, Academy's offer is the highest so far. That's despite that the inn was initially listed last year at nearly double that amount, $15.9 million. And we'll stop there as the article mentions the history behind the inn and also that Memento Mori and Academy have executed a purchase and sale agreement for the property subject to bankruptcy court approval. But the filings also outline a bid process via a stalking horse procedure should higher bidders emerge in the next several days. And finally, we'll mention the Business Survey Pulse. Has the fear of coronavirus affected your business operations or employee work schedule? 192 responses. The no's, 80%. The yes's, 20%. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.